tag stuck to his fin, becoming the accidental but official discoverer of the Yoo-hoo's name. "It's not that I care about who gets the credit," he told Kohler. "It's that it would mean my approach hadn't worked." He worried about how he and Kohler had missed major artifacts in earlier explorations, only to find them lying in the open on later dives. "It's like the crewmen are putting stuff out for me," Chatterton said. "But it's not the stuff I want. It's like they're saying, 'Hey, let's put out the binoculars for him. That'll really get him going.'" Kohler put down his beer. "Listen, John, we can do it," Kohler said. "If I have to row us out here in a canoe, I'll do it. I'm with you. I believe in what we're doing. Let's keep pounding. You tell me what you need, and I'm there. We ain't quitting." It was then that Chatterton fully understood what Kohler had meant to the project. He was a first-rate diver, one of the best, and a passionate and creative researcher. But deeper than that, he was a believer, and as Chatterton watched Kohler reach for a handshake, he knew that this was the most important thing of all, that in a quest in which men were asked to really know themselves, an unflinching belief in the possible survived all. Chatterton shook Kohler's hand. "We ain't quitting," he said. Even as October's autumn settled over New Jersey, Chatterton and Kohler believed they might squeeze in another trip or two to the Yoo-hoo. Nagel, however, was of a different mind. Little more than a skeleton, he was no longer capable of captaining the Seeker. His business had begun to fail. When prospective customers inquired about charters, Nagel would say, "Oh, that's a nice request, but how about this? Fuck you! I'm dying! I don't care about you or your sunny smiles or your bullshit artificial reef wrecks. I never cared anything about you. Don't you get it? I'm gonna die! Goodbye!" As the season wore on, Chatterton found it painful to look at his old friend and mentor. In October, Nagel was rushed by his girlfriend to the hospital, bleeding from the throat. Years of alcohol abuse had caused him to develop esophageal varices, varicose veins in his throat, which had been ruptured. Doctors hurried him to surgery and cauterized the damage. In the recovery room, they told him, "You came within 15 minutes of bleeding to death. If you continue to consume alcohol, even a single drink, we might not be able to save you next time." Nagel's girlfriend broke up with him while he was still in the hospital. She could not bear to watch him kill himself. A few weeks later, Nagel checked himself out of the hospital. On the way home, he stopped at the liquor store. That night, after consuming nearly a full bottle of vodka, he bled to death from the throat. Bill Nagel, one of the greatest shipwreck divers of all time, the man who had taken the bell off the Andrea Doria, was dead at 41. Divers from across the Northeast made plans to attend Nagel's funeral in Pennsylvania. Chatterton, one of his dearest friends, did not. Kohler could not accept that decision. "What do you mean you're not going to the funeral?" Kohler asked. "The guy in that box is not Bill Nagel," Chatterton said. "The guy in that box killed my friend." "You should go," Kohler said. "You need to say goodbye to your friend." Chatterton could not bring himself to attend. At the funeral, Kohler and the other pallbearers lifted Nagel's coffin. As he walked Nagel to the grave, Kohler could not get over the lightness of the box. "It's like there's nothing inside," he thought to himself. And it was then that he wished most of all that Chatterton was beside him. 3 dive seasons had passed since the Yoo-hoo's discovery. Though certain that the wreck was U-857, Chatterton and Kohler were no closer to proving it than they had been in 1991. As winter claimed New Jersey, Chatterton noticed fraying around the edges of his marriage. While he had worked to master the Yoo-hoo, Kathy had become among the finest women pistol shooters in the world. Discordant schedules squeezed the couple's time together, and diverging interests made that time awkward. When Kathy asked about her husband's growing obsession with the U-boat, Chatterton told her, "I'm being tested. What I do with this U-boat is what I am as a person." Neither Chatterton nor Kathy feared for the long-term future of the marriage. They still loved each other and allowed each other space for passions. But sometimes, when Chatterton looked up from his desk and realized that he and Kathy had not spoken for days, it reminded him of his time as a scallop fisherman. Every so often, then, a shadow would creep up on the fishermen as they worked the dredges, sending the men scurrying to track the source of the shadow, which was always a great wave about to punish the boat. Now, at home, Chatterton was beginning to feel the shadow. At Kohler's home, 5 miles away, the wave had already hit the boat. For more than a year, he and his wife, Felicia, had argued over Kohler's availability to her, their 2 small children, and Felicia's 10-year-old daughter from a previous relationship. She understood the necessary evil that was Kohler's glass business. The company was growing and required near-constant attention as Kohler sought to expand it. She had less patience, however, for Kohler's use of his remaining free time. He spent nearly every day of the year working the Yoo-Hoo, diving it, researching it, meeting with Chatterton, whisking off to Washington. He and Felicia seemed to fight every day. Felicia told him, "If you gave up diving, our marriage would improve." That song was Taps for Kohler. Around Christmas, 1993, he and Felicia separated. She moved with the children to Long Island, and he took a bachelor pad on the northeastern tip of the Jersey Shore. He insisted on having his kids every weekend. For a month or two, Kohler reveled in his newfound freedom. He dated young lovelies, danced at nightclubs, and read his U-boat books with impunity. But he missed his son, Richie, daughter, Nikki, and stepdaughter, Jenny Ann. Weekend visits were not enough. He entertained notions of reconciliation with Felicia, but he believed she would not consider it unless he agreed to abandon diving, which would be the same as asking him to abandon food. As February 1994 froze the beaches near his apartment, he became convinced that something would have to change, that he was not in his natural state without his kids to chase off to school. In late February, Chatterton and Kohler received a letter from Robert Coppock at the Ministry of Defense. Standing in his bathrobe and holding a cup of coffee, Chatterton began to read. U-869 was originally bound for the U.S. East Coast and allocated a patrol area about 110 miles southeast of New York. Chatterton went numb. U-869 was Horenberg's boat. It was supposed to have been ordered to Gibraltar. U-869 may not have received a new signal ordering her to Gibraltar. Chatterton's heart pounded against his ribcage. In view of atmospheric conditions, it is certainly possible that Control's new signal ordering U-869 to the Gibraltar area was not received by the boat. Now Chatterton was lightheaded. In the light, therefore, of the absence of any tangible proof that U-869 had received Control's signal ordering her to the Gibraltar area, along with the evidence of the knife and the proximity of the wreck's position to U-869's original patrol area, I would concede that the possibility the wreck is U-869 cannot be ignored. Chatterton rushed to the phone and called Kohler. "Richie, we just got an unbelievable letter from Coppock. He dropped an atomic bomb. You won't believe it." "Slow down," Kohler said. "What's it say?" "It says this. U-869, Horenberg's boat, the one all the history books say was sunk off Gibraltar, was originally ordered to New York. And not just to New York, but just south of New York, right to our wreck site. It says that headquarters later changed those orders to Gibraltar. But get this, Ritchie, and I quote, "It is certainly possible that control signal ordering U-869 to the Gibraltar area was not received by the boat." But what about all the reports that U-869 was sunk off Gibraltar by Allied escort ships? Kohler asked. We've seen how accurate those reports can be, haven't we? Well, this is unbelievable. I'm stunned. Ritchie, can you conference call Kopic from your office? We have to ask him to explain where he got this information. I'm already dialing, Kohler said. A moment later, the phone rang at Great Scotland Yard. Kopic had only a few minutes to talk. He told the divers that his information had been gleaned from reading intercepted radio messages between U-869 and U-boat control in Germany. The intercepted messages and their interpretations by American codebreakers, he said, could be found in Washington, D.C. Chatterton and Kohler sat flabbergasted. They had seen radio intercepts before, but had never dreamed to inspect those relating to U-869, a boat conclusively recorded by history as having been sunk off Gibraltar. None of the experts to whom they had spoken, including Kopic, had thought to do so either. "I'm going to D.C. tomorrow to investigate," Chatterton said. "The whole story is there." Kohler wanted to join Chatterton in Washington, but he was still part of a two-man business and could not free up the time. Instead, Chatterton took Barb Lander, who had long been diving the Yoo-Hoo and who had shown keen interest in its history. Chatterton promised he would call Kohler with details as they unfolded, and took along several rolls of quarters for payphones to do so. Chatterton and Lander landed first at the National Archives, where they requested 10th Fleet U-boat intelligence summaries starting on December 8, 1944, the day U-869 had departed for war. Archivists wheeled out cartloads of documents stamped ULTRA, top secret. Chatterton knew the word ULTRA, the name for the Allied monitoring and decrypting of Enigma. For decades after the war, few had fathomed that the Allies had cracked Enigma and had been reading the German mail. Now Chatterton and Lander were about to read it, too. The divers scanned the U.S. Navy's intelligence summaries. They found a report dated January 3, 1945. Navy intelligence had intercepted radio messages between U-869 and Control. The code breakers wrote, "A U-boat, U-869, now estimated in the central North Atlantic, has been ordered to head for a point about 70 miles southeast of the New York approaches." Chatterton could scarcely believe what he was reading. That would have put U-869 directly on the wreck site. He pressed further. In a report dated January 17, 1945, Navy intelligence wrote, "The U-boat heading for the New York approaches, U-869, Neuerberg, is presently estimated about 180 miles south-southeast of Flemish Cap. She is expected to arrive in the New York area at the beginning of February." Chatterton checked his crew list. Neuerberg was U-869's commander. He kept reading, his heart charging into his ribcage. In a January 25th report, Navy eavesdroppers detected a communication problem between U-869 and Control. "One U-boat may be south of Newfoundland, heading for New York approaches, although her location is uncertain due to a mix-up in orders, and Control assumes she is heading for Gibraltar. But, based on the signals she received, it appears likely that U-869 is continuing toward her original heading off New York." "I can't believe it," Chatterton told Lander. "They were ordered right to our wreck site. Control changed the orders to send the U-boat to Gibraltar. But it looks like U-869 never got those new orders. She just kept heading for New York." "Oh, wow," Lander said, scanning the document. "Read the rest of what the Navy says." The Corps will begin sweeping for this U-boat shortly prior to proceeding against the U-boat's reporting weather in the North Atlantic. The USS Corps was an aircraft carrier attached to a hunter-killer group, Chatterton said. The Navy knew exactly where U-869 was headed and was lying in wait for her. Chatterton took his quarters and ran to the payphone. He called Kohler and told him of his discoveries. Incredible, Kohler said. The Navy sent a hunter-killer group for U-869, but they never got her, never even spotted her. We'd know it if they had. U-boats didn't get away from hunter-killer groups in 1945, John. This Neuerberg must have been some commander. For a moment, there was silence on the line. We didn't find U-857 at all, Kohler finally said. We found U-869. We found U-869, Chatterton said. It was U-869 all along. Still unresolved, however, was the matter of U-869's reported sinking off Gibraltar by two ships, the Landiscray and USS Fowler. Every history book had it recorded that way. Chatterton and Lander raced to the Naval Historical Center and requested attack reports for the sinking of U-869. Minutes later, they were looking at butchered history. On February 28, 1945, the American destroyer escort USS Fowler picked up a sonar contact in the area west of Rabat, southwest of Gibraltar. The Fowler fired a pattern of 13 depth charges. Two explosions followed, and debris of an unknown identity was spotted on the surface. The Fowler fired another pattern of depth charges. When the smoke cleared, crewmen dragged a towel through the debris, which had the appearance of lumps and balls of heavy oil sludge, but no samples were recovered. The destroyer searched the area for further evidence of damage. It found none. Hours later, the French patrol craft, Landiscray, attacked a sonar contact in the same area, which caused a large black object to break surface and immediately sink. The boat could not identify the object and spotted no debris. Navy intelligence was unimpressed with the attacks and the flimsy evidence produced. They graded each of the attacks G, no damage. But Chatterton could see as he read the reports, post-war assessors soon changed the grade from G to B. Probably sunk. Why would they have done that? Lander asked. I've seen this before, Chatterton said. The post-war assessors were scrambling to account for lost U-boats. One of those U-boats was U-869. The assessors have no clue about intercepted radio messages. That was top secret. So they don't know U-869 went to New York. They checked the German records. The Germans believed U-869 went to Gibraltar. They think she got the new orders to go to Gibraltar. When she doesn't come home, the Germans presume her lost off Gibraltar. Then the post-war assessors see these attacks by the Fowler and Landiscray near Gibraltar. They attach the attacks to U-869, change the grade from G to B, and that settles it for them. Chatterton ran back to the payphone. He told Kohler that the history books were wrong. "We found U-869," Kohler said. "We found Horenberg, didn't we?" Horenberg was there the whole time, Chatterton said. Think about it, Richie. If there were radio problems between U-869 and control, Horenberg would have been the guy front and center for it. He was the senior radioman. Listen, Richie, I'm out of quarters, but I'll tell you this. Horenberg must have been there for it all. Chapter 12 None of Us is Coming Back. Deschimag Shipyard, Bremen, Germany, January 1944. In the chill morning of a new year, as ruins still smoldered in Berlin from fresh British bombings, hundreds of young German men from throughout the country made their way to the Deschimag Shipyard in the seaport town of Bremen to begin naval training. Most brought just a simple suitcase of clothes and perhaps a cherished photograph or good luck charm. Perhaps 50 of these men were told they would be the crew of a submarine temporarily titled W-1077. In a few days, that submarine would be commissioned as U-869. Though only a handful of these men had previous U-boat experience, many either had volunteered for submarine service or had been chosen for it because of their technical skills and backgrounds. They were a young group, average age 21, with 22 teenagers, including a 17-year-old, and were worlds away from the cruise of 1939, when the U-boat Waffe selected only the most elite of the elite. Among the most experienced men assigned to U-869 was 22-year-old Herbert Gostrzewski, a radio operator and veteran of three war patrols, all with U-602. Gostrzewski counted himself lucky to be alive. He had been ordered off U-602 just before its most recent patrol. Heavy U-boat casualties had created a shortage of radio operators, and his services were needed elsewhere. Gostrzewski was heartbroken. His crewmen were his brothers, his U-boat his home. U-602 set sail for the Mediterranean. It never returned. As Gostrzewski unpacked that evening in Bremen, he heard a knock at his door. "Who is it?" Gostrzewski asked. "A fellow crewman," came the reply. Gostrzewski opened the door. A handsome man with wavy brown hair and jack-of-spades dark eyes asked if he might come inside. The man introduced himself as Martin Horenberg, the Funkmeister assigned to U-869. He told Gostrzewski that he was looking forward to working with him. Gostrzewski shook Horenberg's hand, but his heart sank. He had expected to be the crew's most senior radio operator. But Horenberg ranked higher. He was a Funkmeister, or a radio master. The men spoke briefly before wishing each other a good night. "At least," Gostrzewski thought as he closed his door, "this fellow seems bright, capable, and friendly. At least Horenberg seems like a gentleman." It would be a few days before the crew was officially assembled. In the meantime, several men assigned to U-869, including Gostrzewski and Horenberg, hopped a cable car to the Deshimag shipyard in hopes of glimpsing their U-boat. Inside the gates, diesel fumes collided with sea and fish, dusting the grounds with the perfume of maritime war. The men asked about U-869. A guard directed them to a dock. And there she was. Lean and stealthy, her cigar-shaped hull grooved into the water at bow and stern, she appeared an eyebrow of the sea, raised for the moment to observe the curious. Everywhere she was painted overcast gray, the most impossible color to see when the world changed from light to dark or dark to light, the times when U-boats were deadliest. Affixed to U-869's conning tower were the Olympic rings, the mark of a boat to be commanded by a graduate of the naval class of 1936, the year of the Berlin Games. For a moment, Gostrzewski stood awestruck before the machine. In every way—weaponry, size, design—it seemed superior to the Type 7 on which he had previously served. "There is no comparison," he thought to himself. "This is a great boat. This is something entirely different." For the next 2 weeks, the men of U-869 joined other crews for general instruction at the shipyard. They would not meet the submarine's top three officers, the commander, first officer, and chief engineer, until the U-boat's commissioning in late January. Until then, they could only speculate about the men who would lead them into war. Commissioning was scheduled for January 26, 1944. On that day, those assigned to U-869 dressed in formal Navy uniforms and made their way to the submarine's dock. It was the first time the men had come together as a crew. An officer took attendance, calling out names. Britzius, Dag, Dietmeyer, Dietz, until each of the crewmen had confirmed himself present. All the while the crew cast their eyes to the side, where a tall, deeply handsome man with black hair, broad shoulders, and penetrating dark eyes was observing the proceedings. They knew this man to be their commander. They could see a nobility in his posture, a certainty in the slowness of his breaths, a strength in his face's Teutonic angles. The man had grown up in a country wallpapered with images of the heroic and invincible U-boat commander, a man for whom anything was possible. Here, in the form of 26-year-old Commander Helmut Neuerberg, that image had come to life. The men climbed aboard the submarine and fell into rows of three on its stern deck, their hands at their sides, standing at attention. Commander Neuerberg looked over his men, over the water, and over Germany. By now the men knew this to be Neuerberg's maiden command. Some even whispered that he had been a Luftwaffe fighter pilot before volunteering for U-boat service. Neuerberg began to address his men from behind the Winter Gardens rail. His speech was short and in proper German, his voice military and exact. He spoke just a few words, all of them official and unemotional. But it took no more than these words for even a U-boat veteran like Gustchevsky to think, "There is great courage and competence in this man. You do not go against this voice. You do not go against this man." After Neuerberg spoke, he gave the order to raise the ship's ensign. When the flag reached the top, Neuerberg saluted it, not with the Nazi Heil, but rather in traditional military style. "The boat is commissioned," Neuerberg announced. And that was it. No one presented Neuerberg with a model of the U-boat, as had been done for Gustchevsky's previous commander on U-602. No brass band played songs of joy and country. The men simply left the boat and returned to shore. "We are living in a different time," Gustchevsky thought. That evening the officers and crew of U-869 gathered for a celebration dinner at a small guest house in Bremen. Seated with Neuerberg were his first officer, 21-year-old Siegfried Brandt, and his chief engineer, 30-year-old Ludwig Kessler. Gustchevsky surveyed the sparse room and saw the direction of Germany. 2 years earlier, he had attended the commissioning dinner for U-602, a raucous feast of pork roast, dumplings, and wine, followed by a party for the crew, officers and enlisted men alike, at Hamburg's famed Reeperbahn. There the men had watched a musical in specially reserved theater seats, then lit up the town. This night there were no parties. Men ate herring and boiled potatoes at unadorned tables, and washed it down with beer. Conversation was reserved. Still, Gustchevsky was excited. His brother Willy had traveled to Bremen to visit him. Earlier that evening, Gustchevsky had asked the cook if he might prepare a plate of food for Willy, one for which Gustchevsky gladly would pay. The cook obliged, and Willy joined his brother and the other crewmen for dinner. Neuerberg rose from his table and approached the brothers. "What is this man doing here?" Neuerberg asked. "He is my brother, sir," Gustchevsky answered. "He made a special trip from Bochum to say goodbye to me." "He is not a member of the crew and is therefore not permitted in the same room as the crew," Neuerberg said. He turned to Willy. "You must leave immediately, sir. You may take your dinner to a different room in this guest house. Your brother may visit you after 10 p.m. Go now." Gustchevsky was stunned. He admired commanders who followed strict military protocol. But he had also prayed that U-869 would be led by a man with a heart. As he watched his brother carry his plate of food from the room, he believed that part of Neuerberg's character still to be in question. Onboard training began after U-869's commissioning. As the men shimmied through the sub's three-deck hatches, they found themselves in a technological wonderland. Swarms of instruments, gauges, dials, tubing, and wiring forested every centimeter of the boat. Everywhere the boat smelled of fresh paint and oil and promise. The clocks, as the men had heard, had been set to Berlin time and would remain so no matter where in the world the U-boat traveled. Not a single photo, not of Hitler or of Dönitz, hung anywhere in the boat. The men spent the next several days loading the submarine and becoming accustomed to U-boat protocol. No one was expected to salute officers aboard the vessel. Officers addressed one another by first name. In a matter of days, even as the U-boat still remained in port, a bond began to form between crewmen, each of whom likely sensed what Dönitz had written years before, that a U-boat crew was a Schicksalgemeinschaft, a community bound by fate. From the start, the crew studied Neuerberg. Whatever the task, he remained cool and restrained, the picture of military discipline. The men listened for him to make jokes as they walked through the officers' mess. But they only heard him engaging in serious conversation with Brandt and Kessler. And always in proper German. He used no slang for the U-boat's equipment, and uttered no profanities. Even as news of Germany's worsening fate trickled into Bremen, Neuerberg betrayed no fear or hesitation. Instead, he spoke of duty. And when he did not speak of duty, he acted and stood and moved as if it were his guiding principle. Though naval officers had to yield membership in a political party while on active duty, including the Nazi Party, the crewmen observed Neuerberg's intensity and wondered if his heart might not belong to the National Socialists. No one, however, wondered about his commitment. As he took them through the first weeks of training, they sensed that this was a man who would die before he disobeyed an order. For all the crew believed about Neuerberg's character, they knew almost nothing about his life. He had flown as a Navy pilot, that much he had told them, and had only recently transferred to the U-boat service. Some crewmen speculated that perhaps Neuerberg had joined the U-boats to treat a sore throat. Slang for an officer's desire to win the Knight's Cross, which was worn around the neck, though Neuerberg did not discuss his motivations. Some had seen his wife, a strikingly beautiful woman, on the grounds one day, though Neuerberg never spoke of family. His privacy did not undermine the men's confidence in their commander. But if there was a mystery among the crew of 869 in the early days of training, that mystery was about the life of the man who had been chosen to lead them. At age 19, Helmut Neuerberg of Strasbourg decided to join the Marines. The choice might have surprised those who knew him. As a young man, he had displayed a natural talent for the violin and a great facility for drawing caricatures, several of which lampooned the adults in his life. He had passed the Abitur, a prerequisite for higher study. Those closest to him expected that he might pursue a career in the arts. This was likely Helmut's intention, even as he joined the Marines. He knew that if he committed to a few years of service, the military would pay him a lump sum upon discharge, money he could then invest in his higher education. He never considered joining the U-boat force. As boys, he and his older brother, Friedhelm, had talked about submarines, but neither of them had been awed by the legend. "There is a big price behind that stardom," they'd reminded each other. "You become a victim very fast in a U-boat." And so Helmut became a naval cadet, class of 1936. The student's class was designated by year of enrollment, not year of graduation. He scored high in most subjects, posting his best marks 1 year in machinery and English. He formed a band while in the service and, as graduation neared, composed a class song, for which he was given a special award by Erich Raeder, the head of the German Navy. Upon graduation, he began pilot training as part of the Naval Air Arm. By 1940, he was an officer flying North Sea reconnaissance missions near England, even strapping his beloved German Shepherd into the cockpit for one mission. For the next 3 years, he continued to fly, to train other pilots, and to earn excellent reviews. But if Helmut's military career looked to be the National Socialist ideal, his heart and mind told a different, more secret story. While Helmut did not dare speak against the Nazi regime publicly, an officer could be executed for such a crime, he had no such reservation when speaking to Friedhelm, a tanker in one of the Army's panzer divisions. During visits, he told Friedhelm that he believed the Nazis to be authoring the downfall of Germany. Friedhelm recoiled at the public nature of his expression. "Are you crazy talking like that in the open?" he asked Helmut, whenever such conversations unfolded. "People are listening everywhere. What you are saying is very dangerous." Helmut continued talking. On one occasion, after he spoke to a Nazi official near Nuremberg, Helmut told Friedhelm that the man's anti-Semitic beliefs were appalling and sickening. Friedhelm begged his brother to stay quiet. "The walls have ears, Helmut," Friedhelm warned. "Everyone listens. Please be very careful with what you say. Simply uttering such ideas aloud can be the end of you." In 1941, Helmut married 22-year-old Erna Maas, the daughter of a brewery owner. Bright, beautiful, and energetic, Erna was also passionately anti-military. The two loved each other deeply. At home, Helmut collected American jazz records, a music form forbidden by the Nazis, and tuned to enemy BBC radio for news of the war, another wartime offense. One morning, while shaving in front of the mirror, he heard a BBC report of America's entry into the conflict. "We have lost this war already," he told Erna. He continued to see Friedhelm whenever possible. He continued talking. "After the war I will get rid of the skirt," he told his brother, referring to his uniform. In 1943, Neuerberg and others were offered a choice. They could remain with the Naval Air Arm or join the U-boats. Those who stayed with the Air Force would go into combat immediately. Those who transferred to submarines might spend a year or more in training before going to battle. Neuerberg was father to a 2-year-old son and a 1-year-old daughter. He chose the U-boats, though he harbored no illusions about their safety. When informing Friedhelm of his decision, he said that he believed U-boat service to be a Himmelsfahrtskommando, a command to report directly to heaven. Neuerberg spent the next 21 months in U-boat training, using leaves to take his 2-year-old son Jürgen for sailboat rides and bounce his infant daughter Jutta on his knee. Just before U-869's commissioning, he spoke to Friedhelm. This time he mentioned nothing of the Nazis. He simply looked his brother in the eye and said, "I'm not coming back." Classroom instruction complete, the U-boat loaded with food and supplies, the crew of U-869 pushed out of Bremen in late January 1944 and steered to the Baltic Sea for several months of training. From this point forward, there would be no true home base. Instruction would be on board the boat, with stops at various Baltic ports. By now, word of Black May, the month in 1943 when Allied forces destroyed 44 U-boats, had trickled down even to the enlisted men. Dock workers whispered about the scores of U-boats that never returned from patrol. Rumors of Allied technological superiority wafted through the naval barracks. Though few spoke of it, The crew of U-869 almost certainly knew that the world had shifted for U-boat men. Early training on U-869 included testing of the sub's underwater noisiness, the repair of its periscope, and practice with its anti-aircraft gun. While U-869 had been built without a deck gun for engaging enemy warships, it retained its anti-aircraft weapon. They practiced roll training, the complex art of turning and diving, until the men were so sick of it, and so good at it, that they believed they could maneuver the 250-foot U-boat through a creek. Some on board vomited until their innards acclimated to underwater life. Others took sick from diesel fumes and noise. Experienced men like Gostchevsky knew that the worst was still to come. The men used February to get to know their jobs and one another. Torpedo operators generally socialized with torpedo operators, machinists with machinists. In the radio room, Gostchevsky and Horenberg groomed two Oberfunkmatte, or radiomen, one of whom was 18 years old, the other 19. Though Gostchevsky still felt a bit wounded that Horenberg outranked him, he found him to be an excellent radioman and a personable fellow. Before long, the two had become synchronized in their teamwork, one coding Neuerberg's messages and the other transmitting them. They also became friends. In addition to his other duties, the radioman played phonograph and radio music for the crew. One day, while in port, Gostchevsky found a wonderful radio station playing Glenn Miller music, the kind he knew the crew loved. He turned up the volume. Feet began tapping and fingers snapping. Then, without warning, a radio announcer interrupted the music and said, "One of your U-boats recently left on patrol, and 2 days later it went missing. We found body parts and pieces of the wreck. In a few days we will know the names of the commander and crew." Gostchevsky lunged for the radio dial. He knew this to be Radio Calais, a British-run propaganda station designed to wage psychological warfare on the Germans. As Gostchevsky cut the sound, Neuerberg stormed into the radio room from his quarters across the hall. "Are you crazy?" Neuerberg exploded. "You are listening to an enemy radio station. The entire crew heard this. How can you possibly do this?"
"I tuned it in because the music was good," Gostchevsky answered. "By the time I realized what was happening, the message was out."
"I will tell you this," Neuerberg fumed. "You will not do this a second time." Neuerberg turned and returned to his quarters. Horenberg drew close to Gostchevsky and rubbed his shoulder. "Don't feel badly about this, Herbert," Horenberg said. "Radio Calais can move anywhere on the dial. You never know where it will be. They even play German music. They know the songs we love. Don't get gray over this, my friend. This could have happened to any radioman, even one as excellent as you." If Neuerberg struck his men as strict and unyielding, few seemed to resent him for it. Each day in the Baltic added to the crew's appreciation for the dangers they would face in battle. And as their imminent war patrol drew nearer, they found themselves watching Neuerberg, anticipating his moves, learning his instincts, studying his eyes for the kind of courage that could inoculate nearly 60 men as depth charges exploded around them and enemy airplanes attacked. Few could deny that in their commander they saw a sculpture of might, right, and duty, a man who demanded excellence not just that his crew might survive, but because he believed that this was the way a man should live. While Neuerberg commanded respect and even a measure of fear, his first officer, 21-year-old Siegfried Brandt, was growing beloved by the crew. In many ways, Brandt was Neuerberg's opposite. He was small of stature, perhaps 5'7", with deeply warm and quiet eyes, and a measured voice flecked with humor. He nearly always seemed to be smiling. In a U-boat culture that shunned close personal relationships between officers and crewmen,
Brandt seemed most in his element among the enlisted men, joking with them while on bridge watch, asking important questions about their families and girlfriends and hometowns, listening to fears and concerns they were officially not permitted to have. While Brandt was fully conversant in military protocol, he rarely insisted on it during downtime, preferring the meaningful conversation and sense of brotherhood that resulted when soldiers believed they could exhale beside superiors. Once, when Gostchevsky told a popular joke about a blowhard military officer, Brandt laughed so hard that Gostchevsky and the others present believed he might pass out. When he caught his breath, he begged, "Oh, please, repeat that. I've never heard that one before." Gostchevsky told it again, all the while thinking, "I would never dare tell this joke to Neuerberg." While Brandt seemed at ease among the enlisted men, he undertook his duties with a palpable gravity. The first officer arranged the boat's bridge watches, kept the sub's torpedoes primed and ready, and directed all torpedo attacks made while surfaced. If the commander died or became incapacitated, the first officer would assume command of the submarine. A good first officer was often rewarded with command of his own U-boat. In his work, Brandt demanded an unrelenting excellence of himself, and, by example rather than voice, he asked the same of the crew. Perhaps more than anyone, Neuerberg appreciated such dedication and competence. In planning or conversation, the two officers seemed in sync and of a single mind. If Neuerberg had reservations about his first officer's closeness to the men, he betrayed them to no one, so that as the weeks passed, many of the crew came to feel close to Brandt, and many wondered about the life of a 21-year-old man who seemed ready to bear the fears of so many. None could have imagined that Brandt, with his easy smile and ready comfort, considered himself to be training in an iron coffin. Even before he joined the Marines, young Siegfried Brandt of Zinten, East Prussia, was known in his town as an Aufrechter Mensch, a genuinely good person. Ziggy, as he was called, had been raised an observant Protestant and a constant gentleman, the eldest of three brothers born to parents open to the world of new ideas and different people. The family believed strongly in their religion, which stood starkly opposed to the Nazi faith in the Thousand-Year Reich. When the Brandts walked to church, the Nazis poked fun at their faith and reminded Siegfried's father, Otto, that on Sundays Ziggy was also required to attend Hitler Youth leadership meetings. Otto told his son, "You may go to your leadership 3 times a month, but on the last Sunday you go only to church." The instruction infuriated local Nazi party members, who might have imprisoned Otto for such insolence had he not served Germany so nobly, and so obviously, in World War I. Otto had lost his left leg fighting for his country. He still had a wound in his chest. During high school, Ziggy and his two best friends had sworn an oath, an odd and even risky pact at a time of crescendoing Nazi power. From this point forward, they vowed, they would conduct themselves according to Prussian principles: discipline, order, honesty, tolerance, reliability, and loyalty. Those things, and not any other ideology, would guide the rest of their lives. As Ziggy's high school graduation drew near and Germany prepared for war, the Nazis became even less patient with the Brandts. The family continued to worship at their church. Otto had refused party membership, and now Ziggy's mother, Elise, was telling the local Nazi party members to back off about Norbert, her middle son. Norbert, unlike Siegfried, was a bit slow academically, perhaps the victim of a learning disability. To the Nazis, such a weakness in the Aryan gene pool could not be tolerated. They told Elise they planned to sterilize Norbert. She told them, in so many words, to go to hell. They threatened to send her to a concentration camp, even though she was married to a war hero, even though her eldest son, Ziggy, was preparing to volunteer for the Navy. She held firm. The tension between the Nazis and the Brandts grew hotter. After high school, Ziggy volunteered for the Navy. In 1941, he began his naval officer training. During his visits home, Ziggy's youngest brother, Hans Georg, eavesdropped and heard Ziggy making jokes about Adolf. Sarcastic snips about how Hitler is the greatest, and how Hitler knows everything, and how Hitler knows more about the Navy than the admirals. Even at 11, Hans Georg knew that his brother neither liked nor trusted Hitler. For a time, Ziggy served aboard a minesweeper. Twice he saw battle action, the second occasion resulting in the sinking of the boat and requiring him to swim to safety. Later, when naval brass asked for volunteers for the U-boat service, the young Brandt raised his hand. In February 1943, Brandt's submarine, U-108, was bombed by onrushing British airplanes and destroyers in the Atlantic west of Gibraltar, its conning tower severely damaged, its ability to dive erased. Crippled, the U-boat limped along the surface toward a base in Lorient, France, a sitting duck for enemy aircraft or ships that happened into the vicinity. The sub made it safely back to port, but the experience left a deep impression on Brandt. During the attack, he had begged the commander to dive, but the man had chosen to wait. As the enemy bore down, Brandt observed the commander looking at photographs of his children, an example of how U-boat combat could paralyze even the finest officer's nerves. During home leaves, Brandt and his friend Fritz played their jazz and swing and talked about the hopelessness of the war. They continued to crack wise about Hitler and to question his leadership and decision-making abilities. If anything, since becoming an officer, Brandt had grown even more scornful of Hitler. Increasingly, however, he seemed resigned to the idea that he and so many others in the military were just cogs in a massive machine. Brandt spent much of the rest of 1943 in U-boat training. Around this time, his brother Norbert, the one the Nazis had threatened to sterilize, joined the army. Zinten's Nazi party members continued to harass Otto and Elise over their church worship and their refusal to join the party, despite the fact that Ziggy was a U-boat officer. Always the threat of deportation to a concentration camp loomed over the Brandt household. Around October 1943, Brandt was made first officer of U-869, a brand-new Type 9 being built at the Deschimag Yard in Bremen. He met the boat's commander, Helmut Neuerberg, and its chief engineer, a vaguely melancholy man named Ludwig Kessler. During training, Brandt was the consummate professional, duty-bound and willing to die for Germany. During his visits home, he referred to U-869 as a Nazi Tauchboot, a Nazi diving boat, his emphasis on the word Nazi sarcastic and derogatory. Sometimes 13-year-old Hans Georg heard his brother call the U-boat an iron coffin. The U-869 crew continued its training into spring 1944, anxious for the first of several tests by inspectors, called the Agru Front, near the Polish fishing peninsula of Hela. At sea, First Officer Brandt took one of three watches, while Commander Neuerberg joined any of the watches that he pleased. The two men appeared strong and experienced to their men, though Neuerberg continued to struggle to squeeze his tall frame and broad shoulders through the narrow deck hatch that led to the control room. U-869 would go through Agrofront testing five times between late March and October. Each time Neuerberg performed excellently, controlling his boat and firing his torpedoes with a marksman's precision. Deadly aim with torpedoes inspired confidence in a U-boat crew, and as the men of U-869 watched Neuerberg kill practice targets, their belief in him as a leader deepened. In alarm or emergency dive training, the crew was quick and nimble, a single organism of unified reflexes built from relentless training and a sober understanding of the odds they faced. In every phase of the Agru front, Neuerberg betrayed not a sliver of fear or apprehension. Like the famed U-boat aces who had become legend by casually perusing a novel as depth charges exploded around their subs, Neuerberg stayed cool, no matter how threatening the moment. His crew grew to respect him even more. Despite their growing proficiency and cohesion as a unit, the men of U-869 remained realists. They knew that only a handful of them had previous U-boat experience. Most knew or suspected that the Allies owned anti-submarine technology for which the Kriegsmarine had no answer. While Gostchevsky and the U-602 crew had laughed often in 1942, he found little levity aboard U-869. Monte Cassino had fallen. The Allies had landed at Normandy. Crewmen's hometowns were being bombed. Scores of U-boats went missing or killed in enemy waters. Germany, it was clear to many, was falling. None, however, dared speak openly of his fears. A soldier who criticized Hitler or the war effort could be charged with Wehrkraftzersetzung, the undermining of military authority, and tried before a war tribunal. No one knew exactly whom to trust. If Gostchevsky witnessed no joking among the men of U-869, he also saw none of the quarreling of his earlier service aboard U-602, none of the screaming matches when men became frustrated or claustrophobic on that boat. Somber and sober, the men of U-869 kept mostly to themselves. Sadly, to Gostchevsky's eyes, no one bickered with anyone. Early in the summer of 1944, while docked in Gotenhafen, Neuerberg arranged an onboard celebration for his crew. Women were not invited. Brandt and Chief Engineer Kessler were sent ashore. Hard liquor, schnapps, and beer flowed freely aboard the submarine. Excellent foods were served. Popular music played on the boat's loudspeakers. Before long, many crewmen were drunk. All the while, Neuerberg took not so much as a sip. He just watched the men, studying their behavior, listening for their opinions. Though inebriated, the crew seemed to whiff the idea of the party. Neuerberg was testing them, feeling for each man's breaking point, waiting for any sign of disloyalty to him or, some likely thought, to the Nazi party. Near his radio room, Gostchevsky drank slowly and thought, "This is unfair. This is not the way to test men." None of the crewmen said a derogatory word. None of them expressed doubts. As the party ended, Gostchevsky thought, "Brandt would not test his crew like this. The two men are opposites." Neuerberg's celebration party caused some crewmen to further contemplate his Nazi party allegiance. Though officers were forbidden to hold party membership, Neuerberg appeared so duty-bound and committed to formal procedure that it would have surprised few if it had turned out that he had Nazi sympathies. One day, as Neuerberg boarded U-869, the crew gave him the Heil, the Nazi salute, in place of their usual military salute. A recent assassination attempt on Hitler had resulted in a new governmental order. Military officers were now to use the Heil salute. Neuerberg tore into the crew, telling them that he expected the military salute and that the Heil was not to be used aboard his boat. Some crewmen tried to explain about the new order. Neuerberg told them he did not care. The Heil would never again be used aboard U-869. If Neuerberg now seemed even more difficult to read, an incident in Hela only furthered the enigma. As the crew prepared to spend the night, Neuerberg announced that they would walk to a special barracks set in the thick woods of the peninsula. Inside, Neuerberg served stark beer, a good and strong beer, and asked the men to gather their chairs in a circle. Inside the circle, he took a guitar, sat down, and began playing beautifully, an event that astounded the crew. No one had known of his musical talent. Neuerberg motioned for the men to join him in singing these lightly patriotic songs.